The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Glenn Beck.
You want to know how to blow a progressive's mind and argument? It's actually pretty easy. It takes about 100 years, but it's a little easy. All you do is you let them all just play out. You just let all of their solutions play out. Because they always break down in the end. And once you get there, then you're just like, oh, wow, this really doesn't work. I mean, it'd be better if we just intellectually thought things through. Case in point, gender. We might do things because it makes people feel good, but along the way, we start denying truths that just start to disrupt absolutely everything. And in the end, you're just denying science. Let me give you this case. Champions of social justice want you to believe that gender is fluid because it makes people feel better. Once the chains of gender science were lifted, the movement went, well, off the chain. By February 2014, there were 58 genders listed. 4 months later, there were 71 genders. Today, there are over 112 listed genders. I'd like to make it 114, but I can't, because they won't allow male and female to actually be on the list of genders. Okay, let's talk science for a second. There are only two genders. Science teaches that X and Y, two genders. Everything else we do, that's fine. You can make you feel good. We can call each other whatever you want to call, but we cannot deny science. No, no, no. Fight for the cause. Okay? Let's go over across the pond. Let's go to London here for a second. Leave it to the Fabian Society to unwittingly make the conservative case for guns without meaning to, because things have broken down in the UK. They've already banned guns. So now they're starting a new initiative, comprehensive knife control. This is fantastic. The mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, he's got a problem. Apparently, it comes as a shock to progressives all over the world, but bad guys and criminals occasionally try to hurt people, and if they can't get a gun, they'll use something else. I know, it's a shocker. Comes from years of intense research that we did. We spent millions of dollars, had to even shut down one of the turtle tunnels, or we thought we were going to have to, but the Fed just printed the money, because you can do that. Anyway, our cousins across the pond thought that they had it all figured out when they banned guns back in the 90s. They did it! As if Neville Chamberlain was speaking from the grave. Peace in our time! But if I may, I'd like to pump the brakes here just a little bit. Crime in the UK has now spiraled out of control. No guns in the country. Yet the murder rate in London has now overtaken that of New York City. Now, how can that be? Well, they've got a problem with knife and acid crimes. Okay. You want to ban something? You want to put some controls on things? I think it's acid, because I can't think of a good reason anyone's walking around with acid. Now, maybe it's just me. I haven't thought it through, but... And you know what? There's also a correlation between acid on the face crimes and... I can't think of it right now, but we probably shouldn't talk about it anyway. So... They're now moving to take away knives. Apparently, the tools criminals use don't really matter to them as long as it gets the job done. You can practically hear the phone call from the Fabian Society Library to the London mayor's office. Bring, bring, bring.
It's me from Fabian Society. Start banning things.
Ah, I can ban lawlessness. No, that won't work. Ban evil.
No, no, I don't recommend that.
Oh, yeah. Let's ban cutlery!
Exactly.
So that's what they did. Operation Spectre. That's the real name of the operation. Stopping random citizens and searching them for any kind of tools of death. Now, the primary boogeyman here was knives. And the mere fact that the UK has gone from banning guns to kitchen cutlery is actually enough for us to laugh and prove our point. But the crackdown on inanimate objects didn't stop there. They're also confiscating, and this is not a joke, scissors, pliers, screwdrivers, and hammers. Pretty much anything that could be used as a weapon. What's next? You know what? They strangled that person to death. I want to ban hands. Congratulations, UK. You won't stop a single crime with this. The only thing you're going to do is impede, citizens from actually getting their work done, make everybody a criminal. You're not going to stop the bloodthirsty civilians that are, actually doing crime. You're going to get those killers that are just looking to assemble their IKEA furniture. Now, eating a steak might be a little difficult as well over in the UK. Banning the tools of criminals and evil men don't really stop crime, but now in the UK, they may stop steak. So a big shout out and a thank you to the London mayor for opening Pandora's box and making a case for the Second Amendment. Because now instead of watching clowns on CNN, I can watch the town halls on the BBC, where they are going to be arguing the evils of their NRA. You know, the National Ratchet Association.
It's Tuesday, April 10th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
David Bonson is a guy who wrote a book called Crisis of Responsibility, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame and How You Can Cure It. And it is really, really good. David is a guy who was more of an economist, was going to write a book on the meltdown of 2008. What was really to blame, if you will, on that, what we haven't done, because we haven't really done anything to fix it. We've only made it worse. But as he started to get into it, he realized that we have a crisis of responsibility, and we welcome David to the program. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm doing great, Glenn. Good to be with you.
This is a great book. Really, really fascinating and really well written. I want to kind of get into the meat of a lot of it and just kind of go over some of the points in your book. First, explain the crisis of responsibility. Explain the theory of just that.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, in line with how you sort of set it up, there was a underlying theme out of the financial crisis, and it really has sort of been baked into the American understanding of what took place, that there was some great big infraction that took place. And if you're left of center, you believe that infraction came out of Wall Street. And if you're right of center, you believe that infraction came from government, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, maybe even Federal Reserve monetary policy. And there's a certain kind of prima facie truth to both sides. Wall Street had its fair share of negligence, and most certainly government housing policy contributed greatly. But the problem was that both narratives, whether on the right or left, were perfectly willing to treat Main Street as a victim of the crisis and to totally ignore Main Street's culpability in the crisis. And so as I studied it further and further, it became just too easy and too simplistic to say that big greedy bankers were giving money to people, and then those people really wanted to pay it back and just couldn't, and the government was asleep at the wheel and forcing the banks to do this and so forth and so on. There was all kinds of policy failure.
So
but
this is this.
There was a responsibility crisis.
So, David, this is not medicine that most people want to hear. And we've talked about it for years when they were saying these were predatory loans. Well, some of them were, but a lot of times, look, I went in. You don't need to ask. I don't need to show you my proof of even a wage. I don't have to prove anything. That was us thinking, well, this is great. And we were in it. They weren't necessarily predatory. They were working almost in some ways with us to create this because we wanted it.
Well, and I actually use the term. There was something very predatory going on, Glenn. It was predatory borrowing. And it's a term I use in the book because the fact of the matter is, best case, you had people that were willing to take loans irresponsibly, that believed they could pay it back, hoped they could pay it back, but were being somewhat reckless. Worst case, they were committing full-blown fraud, absolutely lying and just assuming that even though their cash flow would not enable them to service the mortgage, the property would continue escalating and they would just participate in this little pyramid scheme that became the U.S. housing market from 2004 to 2006. But then as I really delve into in chapter four of the book, this is the part that breaks my heart morally and culturally, is the fact of the matter is we had no financial crisis if it weren't for the people that were perfectly able to meet their loan obligations, that actually could make their payment. Yeah, maybe their house price had gone down in value and it was unfortunate and so forth, but they had the assets, they had the income, but they were allowed to just walk away from the loans. And this is the area that I think warrants a further cultural and moral conversation as to why in 1991 in the savings and loan crisis, when 20% of Americans were upside down on their home, did we have less than 1% of a default rate? And yet in 2008, just 17 years later, not only did you see upwards of 20% of people walking away from their homes, but this is the worst part. They could go to the bar and brag about it on Friday night. That was the part that, to me, indicated this crisis of responsibility.
So there's a great deal of difference now. One of my favorite presidential stories, I think, that very few people know, is about Harry Truman, who I may disagree with his policies here and there. I think was a really decent man. In World War II, he comes back from World War II, and he gets a loan to start a business, and he runs a men's clothing store, he and his partner. They go into business, things, you know, don't go well, and he goes bankrupt, I think, in the mid-20s. It takes him until he's president to pay all those loans back. He doesn't just take the bankruptcy. He says, look, it was my fault that we didn't make it. I borrowed this money, and when I borrowed it, I said I would pay it back. And so I'm going to pay it back. And he paid every person, every lender, he paid back, even though he had the ability to go bankrupt.
That's right. I think that speaks to a certain character and ethos that existed. And in fact, the whole Great Depression, by the way, if you've read some of what Amity Schles has written on it, it's fascinating. It was a culture in which then you could really argue people had tremendous justification in needing to sort of walk away from some obligation. But there was a stigma that said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be a deadbeat. There was struggle. But 2008 was not a situation defined by that legitimate struggle. It was a self-induced problem from excessive greed. And what I argue in the book is that greed at Wall Street that we're all very quick to condemn was exactly the same covetousness on Main Street. Wall Street, they just wore, you know, fancier suits and had more zeros and so forth involved.
Right.
But it was the same, it was cut from the same moral cloth.
Right, and you're not dismissing the hideousness of Wall Street and the greed there that they went through. You're just saying...
No, I'm not. But I will say this, Glenn, this is very important. If we were actually being honest, we would be more critical of Wall Street's incompetence than we would their greed. Wall Street did something horrifically wrong. They bet in big numbers that Main Street would pay their bills. That was the tremendous folly of Wall Street.
Okay. All right. You have to continue to listen to this. If you are looking for some answers and some things of how we got here and how we can fix it, Crisis of Responsibility is a must read. We'll continue with its author in a second.
Glenn Beck.
With David Bahnsen, the author of Crisis of Responsibility. David French did the foreword for it. It's an exceptional book. And David is here to continue the conversation. David, before we move off of the personal responsibility, one of the reasons why we're having that we may have real trouble in the future is because all of us, or many of us, have decided that we're going to take the easier route for one reason or another. And you point out that one of the big signs is the disability insurance that we're now on, and the record numbers, and how that's just not possible to be real.
Well, I mean, it would require a certain leap of faith that is somewhat staggering medically, because 100% of the 700% increase in disability claims over the last 8 years is limited to the area of back pain and anxiety. So somehow you have to believe that there has been absolutely no increase in anything organic or organ-related, neurological, cardio, respiratory, all these things. And yet it just simply comes down to the two areas where any old doctor can write a note and get somebody out. So it's really quite distressing.
It is, because it's a 700% increase.
Yeah, well, 700% in just 8 years. I mean, the numbers going back for a generation are even far worse than even that. And that's tracking those using Social Security.
So what is this telling you, David?
It's telling me that we have right now a segment of the society that is comfortable to live off the public dole, not work, receive compensation for it, and to do so with highly questionable claims about their own physical and mental health. And that the reason for that is the underlying breakdown of morality and breakdown of dignity that is embedded in a work ethic, the very work ethic that made America the greatest nation on earth.
So you point out early in the book that we are addicted to blame, and until we start taking responsibility for ourselves, we're just going to get worse and worse. Where do we begin?
Well, one of the things, you know, I believe very much, as is the case of most really stellar recovery programs for those who have wrestled with personal demons, that of course the very first step is to admit you have a problem. And that's one of the reasons I suggest in the book that the admitting we're in this position and stopping the blame casting. The next time, see, I'm a conservative, limited government advocate, but the next time the government does something that really bothers me, I want to be able to stop and say, okay, the government could be wrong here, but what else could be going on? Not just simply rely on the fact that big government is always and forever the permanent recipient of my frustration, ire, and blame. And likewise, that person who has been fired from a couple corporate jobs and is personally very vindictive at corporate America, to always assume their sort of default psychology is that the man is out to get them, so to speak. Breaking down that mentality in our personal lives, but recognizing that we in fact have it. And I wish very much, as a right-wing guy, that this was something that the left had a monopoly on.
Right.
But I actually think that they had for many years.
Okay, hang on. We're gonna pick it up there. The author of Crisis of Responsibility.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
If you're looking for answers of what the hell happened to my country, how did we get here, what do I do about it, and how do I change my life and my circumstances, a must-read book, Crisis of Responsibility, came out a few weeks ago, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame and How You Can Cure It. David Bahnsen is the author of the book. He describes himself as a National Review kind of conservative. David, you start out with a quote from Foucault, which this is the postmodernism BS radical leftist that really caused, I think, a lot of the arrogance and elitism that we have in academia now. But you follow it with a quote from Gustav Le Bon, who was a critic of socialism. And throughout the book, you kind of, it's almost Jeffersonian in the way you do this, as he wrote a letter between, an argument between his head and his heart. You say there's an even-handedness that we're missing, and we need to really have a balance and hold each side to task.
That's right. I think at the heart of this really intense polarization that we're experiencing in the political culture and this kind of tribalization that has taken place, the ability to somehow magically interpret literally every single event that happens through some sort of partisan lens is a byproduct of the crisis of responsibility, that we have so removed ourselves from family, church, community, that the mediating institutions of society that are so important for good civic life have been discarded, and it's forced us into this kind of obsessive and polarized manner of living.
I feel like we've made our religion our political party.
And that's always the end run of statism. And this is the thing I want to point out, Glenn, because I really believe a target of the audience I had with the book are those who are right now very susceptible to the present populist uprising, which I acknowledge is responding to things that deserve to be responded to. The elites, the big institutionalists have failed. And yet my fear is that by us going forward and saying things like, if we just renegotiate a trade deal with China, all these jobs are coming back to Ohio, instead of acknowledging that there's actually been a total paradigm shift in the culture, not just economically and technologically, but culturally and morally, that what we're doing is setting the table for more statism later. Because when this populist uprising inevitably fails, we're not going to turn to greater individual responsibility, but rather to some sort of messiah to come bail us out. And that messiah has always been the nanny state. And so, that's what I'm trying to avoid.
So we have, and it rings all the way through this book, and it is really, I think, an important book and study that you have done. But I look at things like, for instance, you take on higher education and you say, you know, it's not the either or. What's wrong with universities is not the rising student debt. It's not the spread of relativism. It's both debt and indoctrination, economic and ideological. And so you say, blow the whole business model down, you know, just blow it up and start anew. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. There's no way this can stop as long as they have access to the funds that they have. Parents keep demanding the loans. The government keeps giving the loans. The universities keep taking them, giving a subsidy into the price. So you have never-ending tuition inflation with absolutely no accountability from donors, parents, or students as to the product being presented. So, it's one of the biggest debacles I've ever seen.
So here is the problem that I would like you to help me noodle through. People will say, and we see it in politics all the time, well, I can't not send my kid to college because that's the system. And so it just continues to cycle through this. I've only got two choices. It's a binary choice. I vote for the donkey or the elephant. And so the system is built to keep you in that. How do you convince enough people to break that model?
Like most things, bottom up, one family at a time. And I'm not suggesting, and I actually go to great lengths to say this, that people no longer go to college. What I'm saying is have a thoughtful, intentional conversation the student, the parents, that maybe teachers are involved. What are the goals? What are you trying to accomplish? What is it you're looking to do with your life? For one thing, the lack of that conversation is one of the great reasons I think we have this systemic extended adolescence, where our whole society has decided it's okay for people to be kids all the way through their 20s. I have no problem with people starting these conversations, again, with a lot of open-endedness and vulnerability around them, but looking at what their goals may be. Now, maybe they want to go to college to meet a spouse. Maybe they need specialized vocational training. There's all kinds of reasons to go, but don't go because, A, if you're a parent, you want to be able to brag to your friends where your kid went to school. I think that is one of the biggest drivers of this whole mess, frankly. But also having the student involved in what it is they want out of their life and how is college going to advance it. And so I think that it will not take place overnight. But right now what we're seeing is it's always economic, right? The economics are forcing a cultural moment.
David, there's a lot of people who are, who I think fought for 10, 15, 20 years and have been fighting and fighting and fighting to change this and to do the right thing. And they feel, I think, at this point, nobody's listening. Nobody's changing anything. Nothing happens. I just keep getting on the short end of the stick and I can't afford to live this way anymore. I have to have somebody who is listening to me that is going to plow the way, because I've tried. I think there's a lot of people who have really tried for a long time and they feel like they're just being mowed over.
In terms of the higher education conversation?
No, the whole thing, all of it. Higher education, the jobs, income, they see the direction of the country, they know, but they feel like, what am I going to do? I've tried. I've tried to do everything right and I just keep getting screwed.
And that frustration is perfectly understandable and rational and probably in most cases accurate. And yet, like any other frustration we face, as soon as we're able to sort of calm the emotions, settle down and think through it, the only thing we can do is keep fighting. We cannot give up. The free and virtuous society that I am advocating, that I want as my telos out of this book and out of my life effort, can only come about by an army of people from the bottom up who believe in living morally responsible lives. The frustrations that we feel can never become an abdication of our own responsibility.
You know, David, in the Wharton School of Business, I don't believe they teach moral sentiments. They only teach Wealth of Nations, if they still even teach that. And I think your book is really a new kind of moral sentiments that, you know, if the people don't change, you know, let me rephrase it. What we're going through right now is really a reflection of what we have allowed ourselves to accept or become over a very long period of time. And so we have to fundamentally change, and the system will change.
That's right. It starts with us. And then there's no limit to what we can do. It becomes infectious in our families, infectious in our communities. And a lot of the things I describe or prescribe in Chapter 11, the individual things that I am suggesting people do, that contagious piece takes over. And not only does it bring greater satisfaction and joy in our own lives, but I think serves as an example for how communities need to function. I have an incredible optimism. Even in the face of everything we're dealing with right now, even in this polarized political age and in this dysfunctional and sometimes morally reprobate culture, I have a tremendous amount of optimism that what made us great can make us great again if we stop the blame casting and look forward.
So let me ask you this, David, because I feel the same thing. The more I look at the opportunities that are on the horizon and stop looking at the past, recognize the past, recognize the mistakes, try to correct those mistakes, and then see the opportunities that are on the horizon. I am really, really optimistic, more optimistic than I've been in probably 10 or 15 years. With that being said, I mean, good heavens, we are facing a bucket load of stuff that only the worst times in the world's history was it this bad around the world, or had the seeds of being this bad around the world. Where do you see us in 20 years?
You know, it's very difficult because most project, whatever I predict right now about 20 years has a 0% chance of playing out. It's one thing I've learned as an economist, Glenn, is humility. And these types of predictions are amazing. And also as one who believes in the providence of God, that he has a way of surprising us. Would I say things will be significantly better in 20 years? I can't say that, but I can say this. There are unsustainable things taking place. We talked about the higher education business model. We talked about the lack of school choice opportunity for underprivileged and often minority families. Those things are unsustainable. There will be change there. There will be improvement. The one thing I'll say, for all the good and the bad that can be said around the Donald Trump phenomena, nobody could have predicted it. Nobody saw it coming. And I believe that what will take place in 20 years, just as the fall of communism in the early 90s came out of nowhere, whatever takes place in the next 20 years is likely to shock us all, for good and for bad. But I want us, those who are sort of the remnant, who believe in the values of our country, believe in faith and family, but believe in taking initiative over our own lives. I think that one of the things, Glenn, that is most discouraging is that the backbone of America, that kind of nostalgic image we get of these blue-collar families that just want to, you know, be there with each other, work hard and come home and worship and live together, I fear that that is what's falling apart, that ethos is disintegrating. What I desperately hope we will see over the next 20 years is individuals not only taking responsibility for their own economic well-being, but taking responsibility for their individual decisions, building strong families, and then the one piece that I think is so important I wrote about near the end of the book, getting their joy out of their production, not their consumption. Seeing themselves as image bearers of God that are here to produce on planet Earth and not merely be a consumer. I believe that that alone can change the world.
David, thank you so much. God bless.
The book is Crisis of Responsibility, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame and How You Can Cure It by David Bahnsen. You can get that at bookstores everywhere, as well as following him on Twitter at David, B-A-H-N-S-E-N.
There's still bookstores?
Well, I mean, they're online, but yeah.
Glenn Beck.
Boy, there's still so much to take care of today. This craziness in Washington is just... I don't even know where to begin on that, because I don't know what the truth is. I don't know if anybody is actually looking for the truth anymore. Does it even matter? See, this is why when, you know, Clinton was in office, we were like, you have to have character. You have to have character. And we have dismissed character in almost every aspect of life in Washington, D.C., and yet we still sort of kind of demand it when we need it. But I don't trust anybody in Congress. I'm not sure I trust anybody in the higher levels of the FBI, or do I trust the court system? Do I trust the administration? Do I trust the press? I don't trust anybody. So how are we going to get to know the truth? How do we know that this is a witch hunt? Or it's not a witch hunt.
Well, the safest thing is to wait and see what the information is.
I know.
And we can get out ahead of ourselves because this is a big deal. I mean, we have to step back and say how bananas this situation is.
Oh, this is if they don't have something massive here,
yeah.
This is a banana republic.
Because if you believe Trump, if you like Trump, you might think that it's because they're just going after him more than ever before. And if you don't like him, you might think that Trump is more corrupt than any president before. Whichever side of that you fall on doesn't matter. This is a bonkers situation.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI is raiding the personal attorney of the President of the United States. I mean, this is unbelievable. It really is.
Glenn Beck. Mercury.